Jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu is no joke. It takes years to master.
Martial arts are a vehicle for developing your human potential. And nothing in my life has ever put me in face with reality better than jiu-jitsu.
Training in BJJ offers a powerful lens through which to examine some primary human concerns: truth versus delusion, self-knowledge, ethics, and overcoming fear.
There's more philosophy in our mats than actually philosophy in any Ivy League school.
Welcome to Philosophy.
What up, everybody?
And welcome to another episode of
Philosophy.
My name's Ollie.
My name is Ike.
And how you doing, bro?
I'm chilling like a villain. How are you doing?
I'm fantastic, man. We have a guest who we've been trying to nail down for a long, long time. I solely place the blame on him. But here he is, Jeremy Petley, a.k.a. Ninja.
Hello.
How's it going, man?
Very good. Happy to be here. I'm glad we've finally done this.
Good, good, good. Come a little closer. There get cozy. Get comfortable. And let me ask you the first question we ask everyone who comes on the podcast. How did you get into jiu-jitsu?
Okay, well, I guess as a byproduct of I was into MMA, but kind of just as a hobby, really. So I was getting into MMA, and I was training, I guess, first in this place in Harlow Town, which is just a collection of a few guys in a squash court in this recreation center. So then I found LFF, and that was the first time I was able to train properly. And so I saw all these jiu-jitsu classes through lunchtime, and Muay Thai and MMA and wrestling classes at other times as well. But just predominantly, I would say, because it was a predominantly jiu-jitsu gym, I just lapped up the jiu-jitsu classes, and that's the one thing that I kind of grew to love, trained more than anything else in jiu-jitsu, and I loved that discipline more than the other facet of MMA, for sure. So it's like that, circumstantial more than anything.
Follow-up question.
Go on.
Why don't you train in the gi?
I used to. I look, it's like anything, isn't it? You kind of... you got to distribute your energy levels, and I don't know if I have too many hours in the week anymore to spend the time in the gi.
That's fair enough.
But I let's put it this way, like, if I have a spare month or in between camps and stuff like that, I do from time to time put on the gi if I like to.
Nice enough.
But it's just, I guess it's just not, it's slowly become a little less of a priority. You know, I'm all about that no gi game, you know that.
I know that.
I don't like people grabbing my shit anymore, you know, I was like...
So look, for the audience that don't know who you are, let's get a little background information.
Sure.
You are an MMA fighter.
Yes.
You fought in Bellator. Mm-hmm. You are still fighting in Bellator.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about your career, how you got into it, how it's been going, plans for the future.
Sure. Yeah, so I started training in London Fight Factory, and I got my MMA career off to start, out of the blue kind of thing. You know, as I said, I started off as a hobby, kind of one thing led to another. I had an opportunity to fight for Bama. I guess that would have been the first time that I got a little bit higher up toward the national stage. From my career in Bama, I was then lucky enough to get an opportunity to fight for Bellator, and I've been fighting for them now. I've had 4 fights for them, and touch wood, I like to continue to do so. And who knows, finish my career as the undisputed Bellator featherweight champion would be lovely. Or at least I was going to spend the rest of my career die trying, you know, whatever.
So you'd say you kind of not fell into it, but you started MMA and that was never the plan, to go pro.
Yeah, no, well, especially because I guess I would have been about 20, maybe I was 21, you know, started to train properly, maybe I was 21 or so. And so I guess I just never, at least when I first thought, when I first started training, I hadn't considered, because I thought maybe it was something that you need to be able to, from a kid, you know, be in a discipline of some kind of martial art to give you that level of advantage. I didn't think that myself, never really having any proper training, that I'd be able to come in and fight to, maybe I fight to competitive level. Maybe like I remember asking my coach when I was first there before LFF, the one at Harlow, saying, oh, is there a chance maybe I can like get an amateur fight sometime, and that might be cool, you know? But no, it didn't cross my mind. It gradually happened. It's like, you know, how your goals shift as things happen, and I had my first amateur fight. It was an amateur tournament in Brighton and Hove, and it was like 8-man tournament in the day. And I won that, and then I think maybe after that, I was like, that's when I was beginning to think, like, this is coming naturally to me. Like, I'm not as easy or anything, but I seem to be doing well, you know. It's coming natural. And then after that, I was going to have a semi-pro or another amateur fight. That fell through. And then there was a pro fight that fell onto her lap. So even after just that one amateur tournament, Louise came to me with that fight. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. And so that was it. And just like that, my pro career was on the road. So that's it.
What do you think about it that you wanted to fight? Because some people turn up and they get really good at MMA, but they don't necessarily compete. Some people, maybe they do have a few fights, but they never want to go pro. Like, what do you think was the tipping point where you thought, yeah, okay, I'm gonna have a go at this. I'm gonna step out into that octagon.
I'm not really sure. I think it was, it was like a gradual kind of, maybe it was a gradual kind of seeing how far I was willing to take something. And again, it was like, even if it was a hobby, and again, it wasn't even, maybe I'm simplifying it, but it was kind of, at first it was like, I'm a hobby and a passion and something that I could get good at, something I realized I was good at. Then it was like, all right, this is kind of, I've just had an amateur fight, I just had my first pro fight, it's officially a phase. This is a phase in my life now, okay? And then gradually, surely, I guess I started to have success, and then I was like, okay, now I'm actually competing up there for some of the best, fighting some of the best guys in the country. Okay, now I can say that I'm actually an aspiring, you know, elite athlete here. I'm trying to do something like that, you know? And to the point that now I guess I'm looking myself toward the end of my career. I feel like I have 5 years left in me, and I feel like I still have the chance even to be the best in the world at something, or at least up there with the very best, you know? So it's just funny, yeah, it's hard to explain because these things happen so gradually, but you guess you gradually invest more and more and more, don't you? And then it's like, again, it's like about how far you can take something, you know? So now I think this is where people ask me about, how am I going to end my career? What am I going to end my career? And it's hard to define that, but I think I just want to take it as far as I can, I guess is the best way to say it, right?
Yeah.
And like, actually, like, to get even more perspective, how long ago, like, what's the span of time? Like, when did you start it? Like, which year did you go start?
So it must have been 2021. So maybe 2006 might have been my first pro fight. 2005. I mean, I know this is terrible. I should know these things more. Like, but
maybe 15, 16 years.
Yeah. So I must have been doing this for 15, 16 years. I think when I started competing. So I think it rings a bell. 2005, I think, being my first fight.
Yeah.
So, Jeremy, you know, like, when people talk about the 10,000-hour rule? It takes 10,000 hours to master a skill or something like
that's
that?
That's it.
Like, were you, like, one day training and, like, it hit you? Like, oh! It's like 10,000 hours and it just, like, swept everybody. Like
no one would. It's like growing old. You just don't notice until it happens.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, I think you guys know this because it's like, it all happens to us again and again periodically on some level during our martial art journey. And it's so gradual because all the guys around you are getting better as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it'd be gradual even if you were the one only improving, you know? It's hard to see, isn't it? And until you look at yourself or you look at yourself compete 6 months ago and you realize how much better you are than the person 6 months ago, and then I guess as that gets longer, instead of 6 months, maybe it becomes a couple of years, you remember, you know?
Because I mean, you must be of a certain standard because you coach MMA, you coach privates, you're quite embedded with, like, the London scene as well, not just LFF, but there's other places as well, so that experience level has raised you up as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, like, I guess it's like you guys said, it's been 15 years, so I must have acquired something, right?
You'd hope so. You'd hope so. I mean, me and Iki did, Iki used to do some privates with Jeremy, and I came along from one. I remember that, like, opened my eyes to the takedown game for sure.
Sure. Yeah.
Definitely, like, a different mentality. And we speak a lot about the stuff you showed us on the day, like muddying the waters and throwing something to get something. And,
sure. Yeah.
Which
I
mean, I don't know what you think, but I think that's a big part of martial arts, especially in jiu-jitsu. You throw something, not necessarily to get it, but to get a reaction to then get the thing.
Yeah. Well, having those little setups and philosophies and being able to see the bigger picture. But I think that that's something that I was able to look at closer when I became a coach, because it forces you to, you know?
Yeah.
So I think sometimes, initially, at least as an athlete, you get by on your athletic ability and stuff like that. And you have, you know, I had maybe some raw instincts and I was good at listening and stuff like that. But when you become a coach, definitely it forces you to look at things at a deeper level, and so forces you to hyperanalyze and you start to see things in a different way. And I think because of that, you start to develop, especially from the intellectual part of your game, starts to develop in a different way, you know?
Do you enjoy coaching?
Yeah, I love it, absolutely. Yeah? No, it's great.
Rewarding?
Hugely, man, hugely. You know, seeing other people, being able to pass on the knowledge and just the being able to try to explain and communicate and help people kind of grow and stuff like that, it's very rewarding. It's huge. And it's nice because it, you know, I do have something that I know I can still have some fulfillment in when my career is finally over, you know, as opposed to just drifting into some, you know, obscurity or whatever. Hopefully I got something to cushion that inevitable kind of, you know, the retirement that no guy ever enjoys thinking about. But definitely it's going to be encouraging knowing that when I do hang up my gloves that it's that I've got a nice, hopefully, career in teaching and coaching, hopefully coaching young fighters to get to a reasonable level, a good world level as well, you know.
Your style of teaching is quite unique because it's like a balance between a lot of intensity and at the same time very laid back.
Oh, yeah.
That's actually so accurate. Yeah, I guess that's laid-back okay. Intensity.
Yeah. All right, that's interesting.
Yeah, it's like...
I'm trying to hear what you're pinpointing, okay?
Because it's like the class starts... There's like a lot of intensity in terms of what you expect from the students, like the standard and everything. But at the same time, it's like it's laid-back enough where you still feel like... I'm not here to fight. I'm here to learn kind of thing.
Sure, yeah. You know?
And it's just like... Yeah, the class finishes, you push yourself and you're like, oh, it's over. Kind of like time flies by a lot of times.
You're very attentive as well. Yeah. Like you're really focused on what that person's doing. And if it's good, you get that feedback. If it's bad, you don't. It's like constant. I found that when you're coaching. I tell you what is funny though. When me, Galinio and Josh used to do our privates on the corner during your MMA sparring class, and we'd be drilling something, and on this side there'd be two guys just taking the absolute chunks out of each other.
Oh man, the Saturday mornings, you get that.
And like, how, like for example, when it comes to coaching, right? What do you think actually makes a good coach, and what do you think also makes a good fighter? Or like, a good person to be coached.
Okay, well, I mean, as far as being a good coach, I think that, you know, you need to be able to communicate things, to be able to communicate and explain things well, I think is important. And I think that it's easy for people to, any instructor, personal trainer, martial arts instructor, is easy to come across and recite things that you know and make it, you know, recite the things that from your level 3 essay and make things sound good, you know, and show off what you know. But I think it's a whole nother thing to be able to make someone understand something. And what is it, the old cliche of knowing something well means you should be able to explain it to a 5-year-old clearly, for example, right? Yeah. And so I think that part of it is being able to, you know, be able to look at something and not just understand techniques, moves, principles, philosophies, and all that, and a collection of information, be able to look at the big picture and be able to identify clearly, all right, what's happening here, what do we need to do, and why, you know?
That makes sense.
It's a simple game that can be made complicated by stupid people, I guess, you know?
How many times over your career have you had to explain where you got the nickname Ninja from?
So many times. You're not going to ask me, are you?
No, we're not going to ask.
No, I appreciate that. Because I met the miracle that we got by without the football thing. It was great. I was like,
the only reason I didn't ask.
We're passing the ninja thing, we're passing the football thing. This is fantastic.
The only reason I didn't ask the football one is because you talked about it on the LFF podcast.
I don't know that anyone wants to hear about my football career anymore, not even me.
One thing that I wonder, though, it's like, I mean, you grew up in a place where, and at the time where maybe MMA and jiu-jitsu was not a popular thing. Like, it's not like all the kids are like, hey, what are you doing today? I'm doing jiu-jitsu. Like, how did you get into it? Like,
yeah, no, I mean, when I was aspiring footballer, whatever, we're not talking about that. When I was younger, even when I had other interests, I always really liked combat sports. I'd always been into boxing. And then in 1993, when the UFC happened with Hoist Gracie and Ken Shamrock, because I knew Ken Shamrock from WWE, every kid did. And it was like, oh, there's this WWE, this guy that does the ankle locks, but those are real ankle locks. He's a real fighter. He fights in a cage. And I'm like, what? And then sure enough, we look at 1993, the UFC. So I, like many kids, saw that and it was all like, oh. Like my first glimpse of no holds barred, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Fighting. So obviously that was kind of interesting, you know. So the romance of a combat sport, that wasn't lost. I mean, I've always been a fan of a ruck. And I've never been like, there's no jiu-jitsu class. There were no jiu-jitsu classes to take when I was a teenager, a young man in Canada. I had a lot of big tough friends. I was friends with a lot of the rugby players in my high school, and so we used to wrestle and beat each other up. Well, they beat me up a lot after school in the grass, that kind of thing. So probably that was the kind of things that toughened me up. Or backyard boxing, we'd do a bunch of that bollocks, even though we didn't know what we were doing. But those kind of things, I suppose, you get used to being hit and doing things that make you a tougher dude, you know, as you get older. You know?
Yeah. When you walked out for the first time, were you scared into the octagon?
Oh, yeah.
How did you overcome that?
No, okay, sorry, let me rephrase that. I wasn't scared when I walked out. I was hugely scared before I walked out. But when I was walking out, I was, kind of, as most of my fights have gone, I've been nervous as I've always been beforehand, the day before, days before, weeks before, even progressively to the day before the weigh-in, even, or after the weigh-in, I'll still be quite nervous. And the day I can be very jittery, but when the warm-up's done and when I'm walking out, you know, there's just hyper-focus, you know. You're almost too hyper-alert to be nervous, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But do you, on some level, shit yourself every time? Absolutely. You know, you always have that moment of like, there's that little fight or fright thing where it's like, oh, you know what, oh, I just really don't want to be here right now. It's, you know, because you're human, yeah, everyone has that. And what makes it such a good sport is being able to overcome that, you know. And I think a lot of solo sports have that, like, you get nervous more than a team sport.
Yeah.
I used to do track and field and running and stuff. And like, so I get nervous because the pressure, I felt the pressure solely on myself. But it's different fighting, obviously, because it's the adrenaline and the danger. I'm added to that, right? But yeah, I was scared, sure.
Are you conscious in your fights? Or is it like afterwards, when you remember it, that you like, you're aware of what's going on? Or are you really present and you can understand what's going on?
I'm pretty present in the fight. Things that there's not like an inner dialogue necessarily, but little bullet points, I guess, that are constantly happening.
Yeah.
Is the best way I could describe it. And that would vary, I suppose, going through my career as well. You know, I suppose with the experience, it reduces the chaos a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, that first fight and stuff, the first few fights, and maybe the first time you're hurt and stuff, things are a little bit more able than when you're a lot more familiar a few fights down the line.
Yeah. I suppose it's something you can learn, right? The more you do it, the more
exactly. You familiarize yourself with being a little bit uncomfortable or being hurt, you know, when you're able to tell yourself that you've been here a million times.
Speaking of hurt, we were chatting about injuries before before we fired up the mics. I've managed to pick one up. Go on then. What are yours? What have you listed off? I can see the ears.
I mean, I've my ears. I don't know if they count as injuries as much as trophies or whatever they are. Just, I don't know, they're martial arts culture. I don't know. But yeah, I got me cauliflower ears. That's just obviously just impact after impact. You were saying he had a little rib thing. I popped a rib a couple of times. I've been nothing to my knees or my hips, which has been great. I've got arthritis in both my shoulders. I've had issues in my shoulders and my neck for God knows how long. So, rotator cuff, several dislocations on the left, AC joint on the right. Few concussions. Other than that, though, don't want to worry my mom. But apart from that, I've been quite lucky. I haven't had any major, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I said the worst thing I've had is the shoulders and neck, those kind of things. But again, it's like I can still push through, still get the training done. That's the main thing.
Why do you think you do it then? Because it's obviously got a high risk.
Sure. I think if you asked me on different stages during my career, I would have given an honest, different answer every time. And now it's, we alluded to it before a little bit, as in saying like that I feel like it's, to a certain degree, I'm taking it as far as I can. And I think that let's put it this way, I still feel like I can be the best fighter in the world. You know what I mean? And I think that my goal is still to win the Bellator featherweight title. And I think that when that stops being my goal, that's probably when I'll stop thinking about fighting, you know? But as far as why I'm still doing it, I would say the ultimate reason why is because if I were to stop now, I know that I hadn't taken it as far as I could, and I know that I would have quit when I haven't yet fulfilled my potential. I gotta fulfill my potential. I'm not sure what that is. That maybe that's some tangible ideal that I have of what level of badassery I need to say, all right, I did it. I did something that I feel like I followed through, you know? And I don't know what that is. I mean, maybe I'm giving myself loosely now. I'm looking at myself realistically and saying, well, I can't fight too deep into my 40s. I'm not going to do that to my missus and to my family members and stuff like that. They don't want to see that. But I can give myself 5 or 6 years maybe. Yeah, definitely. That's a 5 or 6 sprint to be the best in the world, the very best I can be. So I guess that's it, is I'm trying to optimize my potential in the best way I can identify that. And and I guess I just want to be able to look back at my career, being able to, like I said, hang my gloves up, move on with the teaching, and leave it all behind, having no regrets, knowing that, I think that's ultimately it, right? Knowing that I did everything I could have done. Yeah. For everything I've sacrificed, everything that it takes from you, you know, this kind of lifestyle, I want to know that I followed it through to the end. I guess that's it.
Good answer.
Yeah. All right. Good. that's not true.
I don't know who said this or where I heard this, but someone saying sort of like, when you look back when you're like 80 years old and you're sitting like thinking back about your life, what are the things that you regret you didn't do? It's like those who hurt you more than the things that maybe you were doing at the time that felt more important, kind of thing.
You don't look back, think about regretting all the things you did do. You always look back at the things you didn't do, the things that passed you by, right?
What advice would you give to someone starting out, some young gun?
Don't do it. Oh my god. No, I mean, I'm saying that with a pinch of salt, but in reality, because it's like, obviously this life's not for everyone. That'd be stupid to say that, to assume that. But to train and to enjoy, because again, it's like, it's so much more than a sport, because it's a fundamental kind of, is the one of the most fundamental skills, because it's something that you inherently can walk down the street and feel. You feel the energy of being able to protect yourself. Yeah, that's something you physically feel, you know? So it's more than being good at something. It's being good at protecting yourself. And that's such a huge thing to have in your back pocket, and such a huge thing that sheds, I think, a level of all sorts of things, all sorts of experiences and wisdoms that you can take through different facets of your life, you know? So I think that you train and try and dedicate yourself. If this is something that you think you can love, a passion that you have, then follow it, train. And if you're one of those that you do want to take it to the highest level you possibly can, then do it. But if you're going to do it, then you need to do everything right. That's the, or you need to do that. You need to do things properly to the best of your ability. Everyone says they want to fight, and everyone says they want to do this, they want to do that. And I've seen it a million times, so many, and only a handful of guys actually are willing to actually do what it takes, do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And actually train when you don't feel motivated and when you don't want to train. And those guys that are like always half-decent, kind of competent regional fighters that will never go to that next level because they're like, oh yeah, they're the talkers, and they're even the guys that maybe get to a certain level, but they're just not ready to commit to that full commitment because they're not ready to leave that comfort of having the freedom of just kind of doing normal things and, you know, this and that. But being having to stick to your regime religiously and do all the things in your life right that make your training the priority and make your progress and your development number one. And when you have a fight, putting that above everything else, and the result of that fight above everything else, that's not that easy to do, you know, to put everything else in your life in the back burner. So for those of you that are thinking of taking up MMA in a serious capacity, I guess that's what I'm saying, then if you're going to do it, you know, but you got to commit fully because it's kind of like something that is like playing with fire, you know. This isn't like, you know, this is something that's kind of hard to be half in with something like this. As far as if you want to do it seriously, you got to do it seriously. But as far as like, you know, like I said, as far as taking up a sport to MMA as a discipline, it's like train, enjoy, absorb the people around, the information from the people around you, your coaches and the other experienced guys, you know, enjoy it. Enjoy developing and go in there without an ego. And man, whatever you become, you know, you never know. It might surpass your initial expectations, you know?
Might surprise yourself.
Exactly. It might surprise yourself, quite right.
Yeah.
Who are the people that, not inspired, but made the biggest difference in your career or your life as a martial artist?
Man, I can't pinpoint one person. I've never had an idol. Whenever someone asks me if there's a particular fighter, for example, I can't say that there were. There were always guys I admired and guys I followed and liked and stuff, and those were all guys that I looked at as those are really athletes I want to be like, you know? But to be honest, I mean, I think that the lessons that I learned and the motivation that I gained were a gradual accumulation of the people very close around me at London Fight Factory and the extended affiliations that embodied a certain level of badassery that I thought was something to admire and to shoot for, you know.
Because there's a few badasses knocking about.
Yeah, no, you can say that. That's an understatement. They're everywhere. But like, and from the coaches that first took me under my wing, like Mancinha and Abel Martinez, like those guys, I looked at those guys and their level, and I saw the way they were and how they lived a lifestyle, and they weren't just talking, they were living it through and through. Like, so it's like those little things. I got the biggest motivation, I guess, was me having a first-hand experience of kind of the good examples of how to conduct yourself, how to train, how to reach a certain level. I got to see that. There were there were certain guys. Nick Furr was another one who was Muay Thai coach for a long time at LFF, and is elsewhere now. But he's another one, fantastic Muay Thai, but fantastic Jiu-Jitsu guy, actually, the Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He's someone, I guess, in my head, I thought, well, that's an incredible level of grappler who, I'd be, oh man, if I could have a competent role with him, I'm doing well. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Those kind of guys, I would look at them and learn from them, and they would that would motivate me hugely. You know, I didn't have to look very far. I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is I didn't need the UFC idols. I had so many like high level guys just around me that I had to admire, you know? It made it closer to home. Maybe that's why it made my goals feel more attainable.
That's a really interesting point. Yeah, you could touch it.
Yeah.
Right? It wasn't like on a TV screen or far removed. Yeah. You could actually see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's what I meant mostly, like in terms of like people you actually met and like taught you stuff.
Yeah.
You saw it firsthand and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, coaches, Machinia. He said in the past, like, they could bring people in to, like, teach and take the classes, but they've always been more about homegrown, like, build our people, build our guys. So, like, there's obviously yourself. There's also people like Galinho that's in there, like, people that they have made from the ground up, which I think is hugely important, right? Like,
I think from a point of view, from maintaining a good core kind of integrity and chemistry in the gym, it's nice to have that organic feeling. And I think also from a bigger point of view, because a gym is, from a philosophical and systemic kind of, they have a, you know, some martial arts gym is good if they have their instructors coming from the ground up, because that way you kind of have a parallel kind of system and philosophy in place. It's important, right? If you get a gym of, what's the word? What's the bloody word I'm looking for? Mercenaries. Thank you, Jesus. If you get a gym of mercenaries, you know what I mean, who have their own way of working, and they're there for the to do their class or whatever. Like I see a lot of gyms do, they have just a collection of coaches, which is not the same thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But when you have a team of instructors who all have came from the same place and have a similar, and even for me, even though I'm the MMA coach, the MMA parts of my the jiu-jitsu parts of my MMA classes, sorry, they are hugely parallel, and you know, it's from a systemic and philosophical point of view, as the jiu-jitsu, the gi as well. So, do you know what I mean? So all those filters, all those things kind of filter through, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they permeate into your game. They must do, right?
It's hugely. It makes it's like an organic gym. An organic gym. It's the systems and all the philosophies. Philosophies will be pointing in the same direction, you know?
I think
that's important.
Do you see yourself owning your own gym?
Definitely. Yeah, of course. I can't imagine what else I'd be doing. I mean, eventually, probably, I doubt very much that I'd be able to do or make too many big steps toward owning my own gym before my career's over, because I think it's kind of pretty, something like that. It's pretty all-consuming. But I would almost look at that like as the inevitable step after my career. It's always something I've wanted to do.
Yeah, nice.
Since I've been in this game, I and since I considered it as a serious lifestyle choice, that's a huge option. Why wouldn't you, right? If I have the opportunity, I think I have the opportunity and the platform, and in maybe 5 or so years, I'd love to try and make something like that happen. Yeah.
Big goals.
Yeah, man. No. Plans. Not even goals. Just now they're just plans, you know? You know, even the word goals these days, they sound so much like, I feel like your goal is something you put up on a pedestal. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
When you know how to achieve something, and you can put the steps in place literally on the calendar and in your notes, things don't feel like goals so much anymore. They're just plans and due dates, and you have a timeline, you know, to things that you want, that you need to obtain. But I think that,
yeah, like sometimes
I don't set goals anymore. I know what I want, you know. I've been setting goals and writing down affirmations my whole career. And I think I'm to the point now that I know exactly what I want and how to get it. And I just need to put all my energy into making the right moves every second of the day to lead to that objective, you know? Sounds like a goal. But
sounds a lot like a goal, yes.
But you know what I mean. You can't put the goal on a pedestal. That's what I'm saying. Don't put the goal on a pedestal.
Yeah, like actually, I think like what you said makes sense. Sort of like, it's a goal, but what are the actionable steps? Like the
day-to-day,
like what it looks like, rather than, oh, when I arrive, finally.
I think so. Yeah, I can get behind that.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I can live and breathe that.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, we always ask this question: like, a white belt comes in first day.
Great question.
Never trained before. You have 6 months to train him for a first competition.
Okay. But let's make it MMA.
Okay.
So usually we say you have a white belt, you've got to go ready for a jiu-jitsu competition.
Okay.
Let's say you have someone brand new, 6 months, they're going to fight.
Okay.
What do you do?
I draw them a plan in their week, and I teach them. I guess I put them to work, and they have to put the hours in. That's fucking it. You have to. I'd help them organize their week, and tell them to get on the train to show up at this time. The easy job for them is all you have to do is show up, right? I mean, I could go over the systematic things that we'd cover, and we could and how you distribute between disciplines and all those technical things. But I think at the end of the day, is the white belt needs to show up, and you need to, you know, plan and distribute his training week appropriately. That's it.
Here's part of the question. In that distributing, because I guess like the problem with that, it's like that there's like a big bias in it of like winning is the main goal, but winning is not necessarily the main goal, especially for a beginner. But considering it is, that is something that like when you're distributing that attention to training, you'll probably put more effort in one percentage for a beginner, like when designing a strategy.
So, say again, Ix? I'm not sure about that.
So, like, when you...
I was with you to a certain degree.
So, when you're designing a strategy for this white belt that just arrived, and he's going to fight in 6 months, never fought before.
Yeah.
There is probably something that you think this would probably be more effective. Of course, it would depend on the person and so on, but let's imagine it's overall. What do you think it would be?
Well, the first thing that makes you want to think is like why you want to compete after 6 months, right? Why you want to make that kind of line? I mean, someone that's training, if they're coming in fresh from MMA, I wouldn't recommend that their first fight should be.
So you turn them away.
Yeah, I mean,
I say no.
I'd say this.
Get your money back.
It's not I would question their motives, perhaps. You know, why are you giving yourself that kind of timeline? You know, this is not a white collar MMA course. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, from the from mechanical side of things, you know, get someone ready in 6 months. There's things you can do, there's things they can do. But, okay, if we're talking more about, like, the kind of... I guess it begs the question, doesn't it? What's your goals? What are your goals?
What are your goals?
What are your goals? Is that what you want to try? Is that what you know, why are you here? You're here to get good so that you can fight in 6 months, then what? You don't want to fight again? Is this something you want to try, like a marathon? People want to do a marathon, never do it again?
Hello.
I hate that shit.
That's me!
Not if I was a marathon runner, maybe I'd hate that shit. But I mean, I hate that approach because with MMA, MMA is not a marathon, and I don't think that's something you could with a fight. And again, I get it, it's like a bucket list thing, I'm not here to tick off your bucket list. Maybe maybe I feel like that's not fulfilling my role.
No, but I like my job description. I like that. That is a good answer. I'm not here to tick off your bucket list.
This is not the gym for you. I'm not the coach for you. That's kind of like the answer.
Yeah, if this is 100%, if you think that this is good, if you want a 12-week program into, or 6 months, whatever it's going to be, and the end goal is to be to have some fight, you know, and then that's kind of it. It's like, I know I've seen some white collar things, you know.
What do you make of the white collar things?
Oh, I think that any banker from wherever he wants to do, if he wants to go. Try and whip someone's ass, get his ass whipped, and train, you know, like an amateur, like whipping amateur, but like to train, to go through some weird rushed training system that somehow defined as some kind of course that's going to give you information that you're going to hold on to, because it won't. It's like crash. It's like a crash study, isn't it, in an essay. You can crash study before you take a test the day before, and you will remember the essay, but if you were to take the essay in 6 months, you won't remember a fucking thing.
Yeah.
So it's not about learning, right? So again, it goes back to what we're talking about, like, here, you want to, it's like, isn't, you can, anybody can do what they want, and like, who am I to judge someone's goals? But I would say there's something a little bit more admirable in wanting to develop in a real way, as opposed to wanting to maybe, quote-unquote, crash diet. Your way to an MMA fight?
Here's why you have given the most interesting answer out of everyone. And bearing in mind, I've asked like world-class jiu-jitsu athletes this, and they've all taken like a bite at it. Here's why you've answered it in the best possible way. Because you've questioned the whole ethos of what you're actually doing. You've questioned why you really want to like do that. The whole point of the question is there's not really a right answer. It just gets people talking.
Sure, and
they can all like throw something at it. But the more you're talking, the more I'm thinking, in order to learn MMA, jiu-jitsu or martial art, you have to dedicate a phenomenal amount of time to it. And one of the things we see in jiu-jitsu is the whole like catering for white belts who aren't prepared to commit and can't see the end goal. So you have to give them these incremental steps. And at the end of it, they'll have learned like a series and a basis of moves, but they won't be on their way. They'll know enough about it as a foundation to then invest the years and the time on top of it. But what they are not is ready at all.
No.
Like, we have blue belts, but the blue belt made me acutely aware of how little I know about jiu-jitsu. Someone summed it up perfectly. Getting your blue belt is like getting to the top of the hill to see the mountain range in front of you. It's like you now know enough to start doing it. And I think what's super interesting is the whole white collar, the six months in MMA. Like, what scenario is this where you're not taking it serious enough?
Because you obviously want to fight. If you want to have a fight, it's like, in a sense, is not giving, is not respecting the fight itself, the event of the fight, because you're obviously not taking that seriously, but it's serious enough that you want to get in there.
And the thing that stood out from what you said to me, it's like, you know, like how you mentioned, like, doing a marathon and never running again.
Yeah.
To train to a fight in 6 months, your life will change so much.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
that, like, after that fight, you probably won't be able to maintain that level of training for a long time. So, like, you just, like, kind of, like, drop out of it. It's like, I got to get my life back in order.
Or maybe the act of doing becomes your motivation to keep going.
Hmm.
Here's a question. You're going to own your own gym at some point. Let's say people do come in and they're like, I've got a white collar thing, or like, I just want to pay you to give me like X amount of services.
Yeah, no, if I had my own gym, it's very similar to how I'm sure Mancini and a lot of other MMA guys and jiu-jitsu guys that would want to maintain the solidarity of their gym, you are solely, as the gym owner and the designated instructors, responsible and in charge of designating your students to fight. I don't like the idea of students coming in deciding that they want to fight and telling you that they'd like to fight at a certain time. I think that a student should be able to come in and tell you they'd like to fight in the future, if that's something they're interested in doing, and to continually pester you, say, hey coach, do you think I'm ready? There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I don't like the idea of a student coming up with his own fights. What for? You know what I mean? And again, it's like, if you want to do that, then sure, but maybe that's not the place. This is not maybe the place to do it. This is a serious gym to do with developing fighting skill, you know?
I 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, you see common patterns between your students? Like, sort of, in terms of what kind of people they are, or like whatever they're looking for, are they looking just to learn how to do a cool trick, or is it, are they trying to find something inside themselves?
I think it depends. Like, you get a mix of people, obviously, but you know, things, there are certain characters to do, obviously, to do with the way we work at LFF and myself personally, the way I run my classes. Obviously, those kind of things you filter out certain unsavory personalities, for example. That's kind of a cultural thing, right? So naturally, you know how it is in LFF. You don't get big egos in here. You don't get guys, pricks. They don't last, you know? They don't last in there. I lost the train of thought.
I think one of the hardest things to build is a culture, because it's almost out of your hands to a certain extent. But what I do think is you can live by certain values, and I don't think there's anyone in LFF that is under the illusion that if you come there and you train, it's hard work. Like, you don't get a free pass.
No.
Like, there are some, the coaches there take it very seriously that you fly their flag. If you go out and you're wearing an LFF rash sure. guard yeah, or, yeah, yeah. or whatever, you know, that's their name and that you are carrying. You need to know what you're doing, and you need to take it seriously.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I think maybe sometimes that escapes people. Mm-hmm. Maybe the 6 month gyms.
No, and that was the thing as well that I again, it's things that I know and I think about or things that I've acquired and seen in front of my own eyes. And you were talking about like how, well, you don't want to be catering to. Good to cater to white belts, as in you need to be able to cater to the beginners that need certain foundational things. Not catering, important, I think, not to cater to petulant delusions, the 6 month stuff. But more important than that, and again, this is about creating culture as well, and it's very easy for gyms to do this because gyms are businesses. And the ones that run the majority of the business is going to be the beginners, right? Those are going to be the majority of the clientele. And I think what a lot of gyms make of the trap is to adhere solely to beginners and not invest in the higher pedigree of your fighters in your gym. Because what I found is that it's like polishing the top filters down hugely. So when you invest in the overall pedigree of your gym, I don't believe in gaps. So I don't think, unless there's a serious issue with your timetable in classes, I don't believe that a gym can have a huge amount of, like let's say a cream of the crop, like a really high level of distinguished type pedigree kind of grapplers, for example. And that they have a series of blue and purple belts that are just substandard or are struggling. Or maybe they're like, okay, they got high level 4 or 5 solid world level black belts, and then underneath them is there some really high level browns and purples. But then the blues and the whites, there's just not that. No, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen that way. From what I've always seen is when there's an established level of pedigree, that always filters down smoothly through the levels. So what I'm saying is I believe that a huge principle to running a successful martial art business is investing in the fighters, investing in the competitive guys in your gym who make up the competitive bulk of your gym. And that seems like it's obvious, but it should be obvious. But I think it's not and can get alluded to because the business side of things, fighters aren't the ones that necessarily make up your memberships when you're looking at the paper. But like I said, it's about creating culture and creating a pedigree in your gym. And something that, I mean, again, obviously I was semi-serious joining MMA and stuff like that. But I think this extends to all sorts of levels of people that want it as a hobby, a self-defense mechanism, or whatever, just as a social thing. I think there's not a single person of any level that would prefer to train in a gym with a less standard of people. Or, you know what I mean? Would they find it maybe less intimidating? I don't think that's ever the case. I think that all levels always want to be training with good guys. Or have them there. Have them in the same room. Be able to see the class afterwards and have that, you know? That's a contagious kind of filtering of quality, you know?
I agree with you, man. 100%. And I want to think that there aren't gyms out there that water it down. But in jiu-jitsu, there are some really big-name gyms that have made a living off catering for the everyman that wants to, like, get to a certain level and then quit and is open about it. And they kind of just... They populate that. That's the whole marketing
and no doubt it's a dichotomy as well, isn't it? Because you can't not be running a business either, because then you undermine the integrity of the house that your high-level guys are under.
The biggest sin is that we have to pay to do this. That's always been the thing, because it gives you the illusion that you get a say in what happens. You're paying for a privilege, and you're going to shut up and listen. But that's always been my take.
Of course. You are paying for a membership. Like, you're paying for a membership, and that membership of this club, that is the effect on that it has on your life overall, is what you're paying for. And if you don't like it, fuck off.
I'm behind you the whole way. But maybe that's why we gravitated towards the same gym reviews and thought, hang on, this got something about it, this place.
Things to think about.
I was actually going to ask you, like, what are the things that you think, at least in classes, you see, like, as people, it's almost like, how do you say, the word is escaping me.
Gargantuan.
No, it's not gargantuan.
He came out with that word the other day. I was like, where the hell do you learn gargantuan from?
It's like, you know, like things that you see in a gym or in a class?
Observe?
Yeah, just things that you see in a class, and then you're like, we could probably skip this part. Like,
sure, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Sort of like they make you cringe, like, this is kind of unnecessary at this point. When you see other people do it, but you can't say it, maybe because you're just watching. Especially in jiu-jitsu, one of the things that not useless, but maybe not as necessary.
You feel like you have done enough of these. Yeah, you feel like this is not quite getting to the point of your ultimate intellectual kind of.
Optimize, like, I guess, the time that you have there to train and to get better, to learn.
Yeah, you. And this is okay. So this kind of, I guess, kind of overlaps on my thoughts on. The way you can use your initiative to optimize your training. Because take a jiu-jitsu class, for example. So let's say maybe someone that's a pretty decent level. So let's say someone's a really good blue belt or purple belt, or let's say a decent blue belt. And maybe they're in a class with beginners and they're doing leg drags and neon belly. And you know, look, you can't do another leg drag to neon belly or else you're going to be sick. You know what I mean? And so what you've got to do is you need to hyperanalyze a little bit what you're doing and concentrate and I guess focus your training on a different level, on a new degree, okay? And you need to, so, and that's what we're talking about, like reviewing basics. It's like, who wants to review basics all the time, and who wants to do high repetition hip escapes again and again? So I think what you have to do is, again, you put things under a microscope, you hyperanalyze your movements to a level of perfection and a level of degree. You've got to engage with that level of perfection to override the mundaneness of a given technique. So it's like you can do leg drags and neon belly, you're sick in the face. But then, all right, don't do leg drags and neon bellies. Get that touch of the handoff between your right hand and your left hand and his ankle. And get that, ba-dum. Get that half volley, boom, the handoff. And then make that coordinate with your diagonal step, boom. And then make that handoff of the from hand to hand, the diagonal step, and of course the second step, the kickstand leg, that one that's going to be supportive leg, boom, and step, it's boom, step, and simultaneously after that step, distributing weight onto the knee, boom, step, knee on belly. Then what is it? It's boom, step, knee on belly, get ready to circle the back, get ready to transition. And I don't need to be a high level guy to look at that. That was just a leg drag, and me just being able to look at, say, someone that meant like Mancini would show me, and just really be hyper sensitive to what I'm looking at, and just try to get that touch.
There's a rhythm, perfect, right? Touch. You can see it.
The rhythm, the touch, the pressure, all those things that you can. I guess it's enhanced sensitivity. You can, you know. So I think there's. And the sensitivity that goes down because when you're doing something of a higher motor mechanical skill or something that you're less used to, because you have to concentrate then more on the materials, the mechanics, as opposed to your sensitivity and your touch, you know? So I guess that's, I know, very roundabout monologued way of saying you can use the initiative, your initiative. If you know how to train, you can, or if you learn how to train properly, you can use your initiative and make decisions on the spot, at least to where you're applying your focus during training, to optimize the drills that you think you've done a million times and that maybe you have. Or to do something which is maybe a little bit below your level. Yes, maybe it's not pushing your barriers enough. Maybe it's not giving you that stimulation, which is not ideal. It's more ideal to have someone push the barriers of their skill level a little bit more, probably. Yeah. But I'm just saying you can't always get that, right? You know, you do classes day in and day out, week in, and sometimes you're going to be there doing extra drills for extra classes, and you're going to find yourself in a drill like that where you're like, oh, I'm not optimizing this. You got to apply your mind. You got to optimize it, you know?
We were drilling arm bars from close guard recently.
Coach got sick and tired of us. Doing Baron Bolos. our coach is a bread and butter basics, like old school guy. And I think basically me and Bill did a Barambolo and I tried it and he was like, nah, that's not your game. And I was like, nah, man, I'm going to show you. This is my game. Anyway, 3 weeks later, it's not my game. So he was like, yeah, it should be arm bars from closed guard. It should be chokes from mount, blah, blah, blah.
It's crazy because like the arm bars from closed guard, it's like, it's one of those things where you're like, I know how to do it. And you just move on to the next thing. But it's like, yeah, like those small details about like how tight am I here? How are my hips switching? And I have another question. And this is actually a question / asking of advice. And it's a double question because in part it's like with conversations I've been having with people who haven't had the chance to come back and train since COVID.
Mm.
And maybe they feel a bit apprehensive. Like, oh my God, I feel excited, but I also feel nervous about like what my skill level is. Yeah, all these things, like
sure,
all this mix of emotions, and they like want to get back, but most probably some will magically just get back right where they were.
Sure.
Some won't. I guess that's one part of the question. My part of the question is that I feel like I don't have a goal at all in jiu-jitsu, at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now, like I don't want to compete, I don't want to do anything. I think like for the longest time, my goal is I just want to be able to make these moves in a way where I feel like I'm expressing myself when I fight. So it's like I want to like beat the shit out of someone, but someone may at the same time make it feel like I was dancing or some shit like that. But it's like I feel like that's more of an ideal thing, right?
Sure.
But like now, I actually have no goal. Like so, my training, I feel like it's not, I don't have like a intrinsic goal. Like I can have like outwards goals about going to class, doing this much, but not like a intrinsic motivation about
sure,
I want to do this for me and stuff like that. How do you deal with those two things? First coming back and the
sure,
one about the intrinsic
sure,
motivation.
Okay. So the coming back thing, coming back is hard. Okay. So let's acknowledge that first. Stopping something and coming back is hard, right? Because the thing that makes something easier or less hard, or the hardness of it easier to cope with, is the routine, right? So getting into a routine, building positive habits, right? So you create positive habits, things are habits. Human habits is easy to maintain, right? And so dragging yourself to training doesn't get as hard, right? But getting back there is hard, right? So I guess a good way to look at it, and I look at this sometimes not necessarily after, it can be after a break and you don't feel like training because of the break, it could be that you're just tired, you have a hard week training, and because of that you don't want to train today.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's a combination of two, maybe you're a little bit feeling a niggle here and there, you're a little bit depressed, who knows, right? For whatever reason, you don't want to train, right? So whatever the reason, break or this or that, it's important to, I guess, an anchor, important to have in your mind that the times that you don't want to train are very significant, because those are the differences. Those training on those days separate you significantly, create an identifiable separation between you and the next guy, okay? Anybody can train when they're motivated and when they just watched someone, you know, bark on something on YouTube and say something amazing.
Stay hard.
And yeah, you know, I don't know what you're watching on YouTube. And people, when they have just a sudden inspiration and they're like, you know what, I'm going to do it today. I'm going to start eating right. I'm going to do that. And that can go on for a little while and we can run on that inspiration, that motivation for a bit. But that's going to run out eventually.
Mm.
Okay, so I think the best thing that I could say to that is that if you're away from a long break, for example, that the most important session for you to turn up to is the one you don't want to go to. And if you're nervous about not wanting to go back to LFF, for example, because you're worried that Iki's going to smash you and you're not ready for that pressure again, because it's been so long, you forgot what it's like, then good. Who the fuck cares? Just get on the train, go on the bus, whatever, turn up, go through the door. What's the worst thing that fucking happened? You're gonna get smashed, so what? I mean, I don't remember anyone that's gone to training and they regretted it, unless they got injured, maybe. Or really, like, overworked themselves, something terrible happened. I can't think of anyone that was like, oh, man, oh, I really can't be fucked for this today. And I'd say, no, come on, you can do it anyway. And then they turned up and they were like, no, that was a bad call. Bro, it just hasn't happened.
I got injured on Saturday and I'm still happy I went.
Yeah, that's what I mean, man. It's the heart, so not only is it important to exercise the muscle of training when you don't want to train, but also it's you'll get more liberation and confidence from it, and you'll get more like, oh, I'm a bit of a machine here. Because I really didn't want to train this day, and I dragged myself to it, you know?
Bro, I could not agree more.
There's micro steps to that as well, you know? So when you really don't want to train, this is for me not like out of a break or something, but rather maybe not even camp, but like, because camp is in itself is a motivator. It's like, it's almost like not training isn't a choice when you got a fight booked, you know? But when you are truly fatigued and you really don't want to train, and you do, it means that you've kind of overcome something, and it means that your level of routine has transcended from something that is controlled through the limitations of your mood and your feelings inside, and you are doing something, literally, because it's there on the whiteboard. You know what I mean? Mm. To be able to wake up and to look at the training regime, and no matter how you feel, to have the list of the things that you need to do in the week, and no matter how you feel, to go through that list anyway, despite however you feel, and then get the end of that, you think you're going to be fucked? You think you're going to feel like life's beating you down? No, you feel like you're kicking the shit out of it. Because you're like, man, I still feel drained, and I feel even more tired. You know, but man, you went to training then, you can feel more tired, and then you'll go to the next session as well, you'll do the same thing, you know?
You defeated yourself.
Yeah, exactly. But what I was saying was like a trick, I guess, that you can keep in reserve for when you're really struggling is not to think too much of the training, because the training can be pretty intimidating when you're really exhausted. The thought of it is soul destroying, to think of you have to do stuff and complete rounds, and that once you're there you're not in control anymore, you have to perform, people are watching you, you know, your coaches and stuff, you have to maintain your dignity and stuff. It's like, but you don't have to do that when you're not there, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So instead of thinking so much about the training, I used to, when I really needed to, I wouldn't talk myself to training, I would just talk myself into packing my bag. So that's the first step, is just to pack your bag for training. And even if it helps to have in your mind to be like, well, it doesn't mean I have to go, I'm just going to pack my bag, you know? I can still, you know, not go, right? And then after that, you can just talk yourself to walking to the bus stop or to the car or to the train station. And after that, you can decide that you're not going to go bail, that you're going to walk all the way to the thing, and you're there now, so you're just going to walk into the door. And you're just going to warm up. You're just going to have a good warm up and see how you feel. And then it's all done. And then you're training, you know? I guess that's the word, to decompartmentalize your journey to training. I mean, I don't know if that's a... But that's something like, again, it's just a little mental trick, isn't it? Just to not think too hard about the training. Because the hard part is not the training. The hard part is turning up.
Yeah.
That's definitely. It, I guess.
I love that.
Me too.
Yeah.
Jez. We've come up to the 1 hour mark.
Amazing, mate. It flew by.
It did, didn't it?
Okay. Actually, one more question.
Oh!
One more question.
Eeks. Do it, man.
One more question, because this is like, I think...
I forgot I didn't answer your question from before.
Yeah, like...
The no-guild goal question. Yeah, all right. Do you want me to say something for that?
Another one.
All right, hit me with another one.
Go for it.
Yeah? All right. Because I was going to say about the no-goal thing. No, I wasn't. I was just gonna ask you, because I mean, like, the noble thing is interesting. So I was gonna delve into that with you a little bit. And I was just gonna say, so, Iki, what is it that you think, when you look at your jiu-jitsu journey, your lifestyle, this holistic kind of healthy habit in your life that you've kind of embraced, what do you want? What do you want?
What do you want?
I mean, are you just doing what I'm saying is... You know, obviously, you know, I know you're a philosophical guy, and this is a philosophical podcast. So I don't know what the word is. Is it a deterministic worldview when you feel like, well, are you just in jiu-jitsu because that's the way, that's the where life took you, and well, okay, sarah sarah, we're all like ants, which probably on some macro level we are, but then looking at the micro iki level, why do you think really you're in the gym, and why? Because you must be there for a reason. So what do you really want? Have you thought about that?
I think like I started training jiu-jitsu because I was just insecure about defending myself.
Sure. Okay.
But then I started noticing the changes it was making in the rest of my life, right? Yeah. Sort of like I really, really like this. And then I think like seeing other people do stuff with their bodies and like controlling another human being and stuff like that, but like not with force, not with everything, with technique and understanding what's going on, almost like outwitting other people and stuff like that. I thought that shit was incredible, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So like I just started doing training, and then I did it. Oh my god, right? So it's like I guess that feeling, and then sometimes like feeling like a little bit like, I guess like when I train, sometimes I feel like I can say certain things. I really struggle to communicate my emotions or what I'm thinking sometimes. But like sometimes I feel like when I train,
it's a level of expression.
I said so much
that I couldn't have said anywhere else. Oh, I get you.
I guess for me, trying to get better and understand techniques so that I can express myself better, I guess.
Nice.
But yeah, I that's what I feel a lot. And I think the thing that I lost is a little bit of that fire, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to show up. I think it's like I think phases in life, like right now in general, is a hard time. So like, getting myself to that mindset, it's like it's twice harder. So like,
I see you say. And I mean, like, look, but the thing is, you mentioned a lot of things as far as like the effect it's had on you. You've the development you've had, the kind of. It had a level of effect where maybe it's opened you up in a certain part of you up where you feel like you can communicate better. But what about... So none of those things are goals. Those are all... Or goal-orientated. They're all representations of kind of the effect that the holistic jiu-jitsu lifestyle has had on you. I mean, I guess the only thing I say is if there's something you're missing or a goal that you're looking for is like, well, maybe the reason you're asking, I don't have a goal, should I have a goal? Maybe the only reason I can think is that the missing link or the missing thing is that you want to train a little bit more and you're not. Maybe you just want to train a little bit more than what you're training now. That's an easy goal to accomplish, right?
Yeah, that's kind of true.
You know what I mean?
True, yeah.
So that's often that's like, well, you don't have to have a special goal, man. Do you really? You live in your jiu-jitsu, best jiu-jitsu life, man. Fucking don't waste time on all the things that you're trying to shoot for. You're in it right now. Sounds like you're being in the present pretty well. You know what I mean? Maybe I'd just say, well, if there's some void, because you would be asking me if there wasn't maybe some part of you that maybe is thinking that you should have a goal or there's something missing. I don't know. But the common sense would say, well, maybe if there is something, maybe it's just that you would try training a little bit more. That could be you know what I mean? That's like,
true.
The doctor is going to give you the medicine. It's like that.
Maybe he just wants to go teach film.
It's like, that's the antidepressants. It's the antidepressants, isn't it? Doctor is going to chuck some damn antidepressants in it. You ask an MMA coach, he's going to tell you, well, you need to train more.
You know? There's that Brazilian joke. It says like a student goes up to his teacher, and he goes like, your jiu-jitsu teacher, he goes like, my jiu-jitsu is not improving. I've been training so hard. He's like, have you been, and the coach goes like, have you been watching the birds? He's like, yes. Have you been watching the butterflies? Yes. Have you been feeling the weather and the wind hitting your face? Yes. Like, that's because you're doing all that shit.
I've seen there's a meme that's just like that. It's good. It's good.
And the last question, man. I think we've been all like living like a very interesting moment in our lives, you know? I think when we have grandkids and stuff, like my dad tells me about the Berlin Wall and stuff like that, I'll be like, yeah, coronavirus. Right? So it's like...
Yeah, you're going to be a sad-ass grandpa.
You know what I mean?
I don't want to be your grandkids.
So
But you know what I mean.
Papa Iki, tell me about the COVID again. Oh, kill me. You know what I mean? Can you imagine that? Oh, if my grandkids ask me about the COVID, I bet no. Watch these old question times.
Feel that, Jess. You love Zoom.
Oh my god. We're going through what was it? We're going through this weird thing in our lives. So I guess one thing, I just want to pretend it's not happening.
In a way, I think like one thing that a lot of people had to come out of, it's almost like a they're going in one direction and they either had to slow down or, you know, sort of like rearrange things and stuff like that. And in your fighting career, you don't always win. There are times where you have like hard losses that make you have to take a seat back and stuff like that. I wonder, like, how do you go about that? Because I guess like sometimes it might be depressive and like feel very alone. Because at the end of the day, it's like you have like all of us, friends, coaches, and stuff. But like when you get in the ring, it's what you're saying, the pressure of I have to perform, it's on me. It's also like when you lose, maybe I don't know how it feels, you know, so.
Yeah, losing sucks for sure. And it's hard to come back from, the special kind of solo sport that's combat sports, martial arts, competition, stuff like that. It's like losing obviously takes a certain toll that other sports don't. And I guess you're trying to draw a parallel between the kind of feeling that people might be having from this, this disturbance, this massive disturbance in their lives, like it's a real disturbance in their habits and in their lives, the way a loss would mess you up for sure. And so I guess, I mean, I can't tell people how to, you know, because people are in this, probably in a lot of dark places from where they're.
I'd say this. Perhaps the best question is, how do you handle that? Because the thing that the parallel I see is that sometimes you do everything right and things just don't turn out
your way. Sure.
It's like, from what I see, it's like a lot of people were doing everything right and then life happened.
Yeah, so.
I guess perhaps there is something there, but even if there isn't, how do you handle
it? Yeah, and I guess I can, you know, draw a parallel with, like, many times in my career when I felt like everything went right and then I still didn't get the results in the night. And I had a stage in my career where I lost 4 back-to-back fights, and it was like each camp was like a revelation, and I felt like a new guy, and I just couldn't work out why I just couldn't win a fight, you know? So these kind of things that bring you down, you need to find a way to overcome them. And I think the only thing to do is to, it's going to suck, right? And it's never fun or easy. And I think the best way to motivate yourself maybe is to find some nobility in the strength of overcoming something so hard, you know? There's a reason why Rocky was such a big movie. Is because, and there's a reason why, in my opinion, I don't think anybody really makes Superman movies anymore, or I don't think Superman's like the biggest fucking Marvel character anymore, is because people are inspired by and motivated by the thought of achieving something by overcoming incredible adversity, right? That's the essence of it, isn't it? That's what makes something so great. It's like something that came to you so easily. That's why people really want to hate people, fighters, that, you know, that come on scene, like the Conor McGregor thing, you know, when it felt like, oh, he was winning, he got an easy ride or whatever, you know, which is whatever here and there. But people want to, and they're moved by that, the thought of overcoming adversity and the nobility of strength in the presence of fear and the presence of obstacles, you know? So I think you've got to find a way of having your down moments and your losses, taking your defeats and turning them into your Rocky moments. They need to be perceived as your opportunities for comebacks. And if you can't, if you cannot look at your losses as those are the beginnings, all right, this is just building up into my biggest comeback, and this is what I started to think towards after my fourth loss. And I think after my fourth loss, and I took a bit of time out, but I was just training and working and getting ready to come back. And I think that I was at peace with the fact that everything had happened because it had happened, and that I was in this situation, this perfect situation to bring my career, to revive my career out from the ashes, and to do it in a way, you know, that meant I had to be incredibly strong and overcome levels of adversity and my own thoughts and my mind and things like that. And it's not, like I said, there's no easy answer, so it's like not really a hack or anything, but I guess just a perspective or a way of looking at it, which is like when things are really tough and when, even when you're doing things really right and you still lose, that's one hard one to swallow. You just need to look at that like, you know what, like life is just handing me another shit hand so that I can exercise even more how much of a resilient motherfucker I am. You know what I mean? It needs to be like that. Or else we're going to get weaker from our losses, not stronger, you know.
Well, bro.
I guess that's the best way to say, you know.
Great answer. Jez, anything else you want to add?
Just thank you for having me, guys.
Thank you for coming. You know,
love to come chat to you guys again whenever I can.
Thank you so much. We always give the space. We know you don't just teach at LFF. You also give a lot of private classes. So if you want to offer the space...
Shameless plug.
That's it. Well, of course, guys. I mean, I'm a working boy, so I train hard. I work hard. I try and get my privates in my... I run this MMA team at London Fight Factory to the very best of my ability. And anyone who would like to come and work with us and see how we work and what kind of an effect maybe we can have on your life, then, you know, all we have to do is come down the gym, LFF. You want to work with me personally, privates, I'm sure I always, if I can, I'll spare an hour in my week so that we can get some work in. But ultimately, guys, it's like you want to come down LFF and see if this kind of, if this life is for you, all you have to do is walk in the door.
But for longer than 6 months.
But, well...
Before you go, there's one thing I want to add also. Two things I've heard in your classes that stay with me for the rest of my life. One is... Muddy the canvas.
Muddy the canvas, of course.
And the second one is malandro. Can you just explain what those two mean to whoever is got... Because if you ever do a private...
I don't remember going many a long time on the Malandro. I used to say a little bit of Malandro.
By the way, I know Malandro because that just came really left field. I was like, what?
Oh man, no, because I have obviously, you know, in this business you know a lot of Brazilians, and of course my other half is Brazilian.
Yeah.
So I know if, you know, fellow. Poco Portuguese. No. but not really. So nobody come up to speak Portuguese to me, because then I'd be like...
So what does malandro mean, and what does
muddy the canvas mean? Well, what is a malandro? It's like a... that's the Brazilian expression for someone who kind of gets away. He's a hustler, isn't he? He gets through life in his cheeky ways, doing as little work as possible, but with a wit that kind of facilitates that, I think.
And that's more or less the way I remember two guys were fighting, and you had man, you have to be malandro. You shouldn't use all this effort. Yeah,
and again, probably some Brazilians are going to look at me and be like, yeah, that's not the good way to use. I wasn't using a good analogy. But I don't know. I guess probably I was using it you have to be clever with your energy levels. Probably you have to find a sneaky way to do things.
Yeah.
So as not to use more energy than necessary, right? So probably that might have been the analogy. I guess that makes sense, right? What was the other one then?
Muddy the canvas.
Look, so I mean, you can look at muddy and the canvas in a few different ways. So I remember when I talked to Ollie and Iki about muddy the canvas, it was to do with the initial approach into a jiu-jitsu game from standing, right? Of course, and just it was to do with coordinating a formula of threats and actions. To control the wrists, to grab the leg, to control the head. You can, and we can, of course, as we were talking about, at that time, we talked about also, you know, going a little... We also have the risk controls for the arm drags, the risk controls for the two-on-ones. Having certain threats, just basic initial threats to gain the first advantages, right? And I think it was about having that the formula of attacks and steps in place, easy and clear, that you need to be able to muddy the canvas. So what I mean by that, muddying the canvas, then... May as well get into it. So there was this TV show on Sky Atlantic or something like that called Portrait Artist of the Year. And this woman, she was kind of a very stylistic kind of an artist. And so what she was explaining is that she found when she started painting... the blank canvas staring back at her and the prospect of where she was going to put her first few brush strokes as intimidating and staggered her, give her a sense of, I don't know, painter's block or whatever. And so what she would do is she'd muddy the canvas, putting earthy browns and greens and a lot of crap all over it, and then from that she'd be able to see more clearly in her mind and derive what she was, the line she was going to take from those initial splashes and splooshes, right? And so that was the principle, I guess, I used in the analogy for muddying the canvas for the initial approach of the jiu-jitsu. This could also be for the initial approach of MMA as well, for when you're standing. But often, and again, it's not always, but often, the muddying the canvas principle applies well when there's space. Because where there's space is where there's the uncertainty, a lack of contact, and... quick kinetic energy can generate, so like there's a lot of speed and quick reactions I need to account for, so there's a lot of so there's a big blank canvas in there, you know. And so I guess that's the best way to describe it is muddying the canvas is identifying and formulating a series of basic attacks to give yourself a couple of actions so that you don't get caught in two minds, so that you don't get caught like deer in the headlights hesitating, but rather you always have something to go to, you know. So to be able to play with something and attack or make movements towards certain steps without having to commit too far, right? To being able to muddy the canvas in start the interaction between you and your opponent, and in doing so from that arising the opportunities to attack, you know, making the muddy canvas so you know where to draw your lines properly. And again, like, I know that's so meta, we could have explained deeper if we would talk like specific moves, and that would be like a private session. I think that's the best way to say it, right?
Like a Maland
muddy the canvas. Yeah, well, that's it. Best way.
Thank you so much for coming here.
Yeah,
James. Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys. Yeah, awesome. Yeah, awesome. Love you guys. Thanks.